From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today, another in our series of discussions about the presidential election here in the United States with Professor Anthony Montero via Skype from Philadelphia. We spoke with him Friday morning. Professor Montero, I'm thinking of the concept of buoyancy, of to me, like physical experience of it is holding down a beach ball in a swimming pool, you know, and it is irresistible. Mm-hmm. It just comes up. And for all the times they've pronounced Donald Trump done, cooked, over in the last 8-10 months, year, you know, the next day they're talking about him yet again because he didn't go away, and he's buoyant. And what he represents is buoyant.
Yeah, I think that... And what it represents is the magnitude of the crisis. And the economic crisis of 2008-2009, and I'm using their framework,
right,
because as we know, it has continued for most working and lower middle class people and the poor. But now we're having the political crisis that grows out of the economic crisis.
Right.
And Trump is obviously a broken vessel. He is not the most articulate and not the best figure to maybe, I don't know, but in the sense of what the media thinks should be the characteristics of a president, he doesn't really fit it. But he fits perfectly the characteristics of a populist figure in the midst of a profound, almost existential crisis of the system.
Yeah.
So he, you know, it's a crazy thing. We've never seen this before, but it is representative of a crisis. What some social scientists have called a breakdown crisis, what Marx called a momenti mori, a reminder of systemic death, and I'm convinced that's where we are, and that's why he's still in the race, and that's why he has a chance to win this thing. And now, you know, once the election is over, there are a whole number of other questions that have to be engaged. But nonetheless, he is the manifestation of a crisis.
You know, we got in reference to your characterization of him, accurate as hell, in my opinion, as an imperfect vessel. I'm getting some more water imagery here of, and this is the sight gag that you've seen of someone with a cup that has holes poked in the bottom, sticking it into a stream and trying to drink water as it all falls out to bottom.
And
you know, you have the beach ball popping to the surface as an irresistible force, and then it like pours down again with, you know, whatever faux pas or attack is presented to us as to depress him or depress the numbers. We're talking here. Let's see, if you talk about a crisis of condition in terms of economics for working people, which produces the crisis of confidence or legitimacy in the political institutions, and that's what we're seeing manifest with Trump as a candidate or Trump's campaign, and also the Jill Stein's campaign, and and still I don't believe the numbers, but Gary Johnson's campaign as well. You know, we're still 11 days out as we're talking now, and we still, you know, we've seen the financial institutions tremble a couple times, watching the markets and such. And so it's still possible you could have some catastrophic event that would goose the election. But absent that, this, you know, people have spoken about this phenomenon of people that are going to vote for Trump when they're being polled. People that are going to vote for him, they may not even know it because they don't want to admit it. But once they get in there, they're going to pull the lever because they've just had it. How significant a factor do you think that is out there with things the way they are right now without an added catastrophe?
Yeah, I think it's quite significant. I mean, and no one can predict what people will do on election day. And by that I mean, not only will they vote for Hillary or Jill Stein or Johnson or Trump, but his vote, all the outsider votes are unpredictable. We just don't know. And in terms of Hillary, her voters are more predictable,
right,
but in terms of what they do if they come out.
Right.
But what is unpredictable
for her side
is whether her people will vote.
Right.
Now, she relies upon millennials and blacks and Latinos, and the incentive for them to vote is very, very low. I think they played this anti-Trump thing as far as it will go. It's played out. People are tired of it, and it's not incentivizing her voters. On the other side, you know, the Trump people are fired up.
Right.
And he's still having these huge rallies. And since a lot of people no longer trust the media or the polls or the pollsters or any of the institutions associated with the establishment, they treat, for example, pollsters with utter contempt. And they feel very, that is almost their duty sometimes, to lie to them, to create confusion and chaos. And again, I guess I would, you know, kind of end on this. I mean, besides a crisis, we are entering a period of political chaos, of ungovernability, of a legitimation crisis, of systemic breakdown, of literally the end of the two-party system. Clearly, the Republican Party, as we have known it, is done. It will probably break off into at least three separate parties. Yep. The Trump people, large numbers of them, are never going back into the Republican Party. Paul Ryan, who they want to tout as the next national leader of the Republican Party, is in trouble in Congress. And the question is, will he go the way of John Boehner, the previous Speaker of the House, who was brought down by Republicans?
Yes.
So I think we're at a stage of, again, what you could broadly call political chaos, of the breakdown of the political system, the end of the two-party system, clearly the end of the Republican Party. And I think after the election, the, and I put quotes, progressive or left wing of the Democratic Party will decide, will it break with the Clinton establishment wing of the party and prepare probably in congressional and other races, and certainly preparing for 2020, how they will organize themselves. I think they're going to break from the Democratic Party. Now, my last point is this. You mentioned the bubble bursting, the Wall Street bubble bursting, and that will depend a lot upon what the Federal Reserve does, what Janet Yellen and those do.
Short-term,
but the other thing is this looming threat of war with Russia and world war, and that will clearly be the end of the Democratic Party, because this will be the third Democratic president, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, and if Hillary wins, Hillary Clinton, that has taken the nation to war and deepening austerity while claiming they would do the opposite.
Yeah. There's like a divine justice here with these political parties bringing chaos as foreign policy to all these different countries to have, you know, the chickens come home to roost. Looking at the voting, people are going in. Okay, the motivating factors for Clinton voters, on the negative side, her negative numbers. Those numbers mm-hmm. tell people I ain't lifting a finger for her. And the affirmative motivation being Trump is dangerous and scary, got to keep him out. And that is more a construct of the of a media campaign with his full cooperation. I'm not saying, but it's virtual as opposed to material. Whereas Trump voters are motivated by, on the one hand, his negatives, and they you can't underestimate those. They're more or less par with hers, according to the polling data, for whatever that's worth. And the affirmative one, though, is their own material condition, which is not going to dissipate or go away. They don't have to turn the TV on for another dose of it to get riled up. They just wake up in their lives. And that is going to motivate them to go out and, you know, basically throw a political shaft at the electoral system, even if they're not enthusiastic about Trump per se.
Yeah, well, a lot of them won't vote. I mean, you know, just imagine if you're in, for example, the United Automobile Workers or the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, or even SEIU, one of those big national unions that are generally associated with political activism and election day, get out the vote campaigns and all that type of thing. If you are a member of one of those unions, not in the leadership, but just a dues-paying member.
Rank and file.
Rank and file. Think, what would it, I mean, would you be motivated by what your leaders and the Democratic Party are telling you? And I think not. I think the rank and file of the labor movement are more in sync with the working class and poor part of the Trump coalition, which I think represents the majority of it. You have more in common with them. They're your friends. They're people who work in situations and jobs similar to yours. So I am thinking that the labor movement, which usually spends hundreds of millions of dollars on election day and in campaigns for president, are having their message fall short, and it's hollow in terms of motivating their membership. I think the same thing with the black community. They look around them, and really, although they don't say it publicly, if asked, are you doing better since the 8 years of Barack Obama? I think most black people, when they think about it, would say, no, we are not doing better. In fact, we're doing worse. We've lost our homes. We've lost our jobs. We're working at very low-paying jobs. We are unable to pay our debts, and we're unable to send our kids to college. That's what most black people would say. And if you're from places like Flint or parts of North Philadelphia or West Philadelphia, if you are from Cleveland or Cincinnati or Birmingham or anywhere in this country, these very, very poor cities, and you are black, there is no reason for you to vote for Hillary Clinton. And I think this signifies a growing divide between what is known as the black misleadership class, this parasitic Wall Street and Democratic Party held up leadership, and the great mass of black people. And that divide is going to intensify going forward. But I think, again, as you have said, while I, you know, probabilities would suggest Hillary, for a number of reasons, winning on November 8th, but Trump is in it and could still win.
You know, going back to that leaky cup, Trump, and, you know, a black person probably the one that pays the bills in the family, whoever's, you know, got to write the checks for everything at the end of the month or whatever, who would be in touch particularly with that stuff. Like in my house, it was my wife, and whatever delusions I had about what was going on out in the world, she would remind me at the 30th of the month that this is what's reality. So that person, looking around the landscape, this interesting conversation took place that they, you know, the media called Trump's outreach to the black community, where he was saying, look around, your schools are failing, you're this, you're that, you're out of work, you're getting shot, blah, 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 blah. Regardless of the leaky cup being the vessel, and given the tradition of people's relationship to the Democratic Party and to the Clintons and all of that, and the way it was played in the media, do you think that the actual content with Trump saying this is your condition and Clinton saying you're insulting people by saying that, not everyone's like that. Well, how do you think that's really going to play out when people walk into a voting booth?
Well, see, I think, you know, I think you hit on something very important. The two principal narratives of the two campaigns, the Democrats and Hillary, and this they do every 4 years, have to say to the people, we have made progress. And they have to have that narrative because a Democrat has held the White House for 8 years now. And so they have to have a narrative of progress, and we will fix whatever's broken, but overall there's been progress. Now, that narrative has fallen on hard times. It didn't fly because we haven't made progress, and people know we haven't made progress, and the symbols of progress are not the same as progress itself. On the other side, Trump has run a campaign based upon the fact that the economy is stagnant, that the trade deals have taken jobs out of the country, and that the Democrats want to take us to war with Russia. Now, the mainstream media, the corporate media, and the Democrats have claimed that that is a dark narrative, that it is not accurate, and that that Trump is a pathological liar, and he's creating a sense of things that doesn't really exist. Now, but when he says to black people, your neighborhoods are crumbling, your schools are in decline, there is not safety, because of the unemployment and the hard economic times, and if this is what the Democrats have given you, and they come every 4 years or every 2 years to say to you, well, we're working for you. If this is what working for you looks like, you need to abandon them and give me a chance. Right. Now, how strongly that appeals to the poor and working class among black people, I don't know. The other thing is that appeal might work better in the Midwest than it does on either the East or West Coast. And it might work better in the South than it does in the East and West Coast among black people, because the conditions of life in the sense of the machine, political organization of the Democratic Party, and the information media. So Trump might be heard in a different way in Indiana, in Gary, Indiana, or Flint, Michigan, than he's heard, let us say, in Washington, D.C., or he's heard differently in Macon, Georgia, or Birmingham, Alabama, among black people again, than he's heard in Los Angeles or parts of New Mexico.
Right. I mean, you know, we're talking here, and the first comparison you made, for example, you also see a difference between a member of the UAW who hasn't had a job in like 11 years and out in those cities, Gary and Detroit, say, or wherever, and in Washington, D.C., somebody had asked me, you know, who has a job, because the federal government's still in business, you know.
Right.
And so they would have a different perception of it, too. But, the thing I'm trying to probe is, like, there's the virtual imagery that comes out of the television set, which is the form of the presentation. And then there is the actual message. If somebody hears you don't have a job and your schools are failing and, you know, you're getting, mm-hmm. you know, mugged on the street because everybody needs a job and nobody's got one, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera. Mm-hmm. If that's your experience, I'm wondering, like, about the gravitational pull in people between baselining, no matter how it comes out of the TV, when somebody says that and it describes their experience. And they're getting a counter narrative that is really just crafted to try to change your mind about the way you're looking at your own life, basically. Mm-hmm. I wonder how effective mm-hmm. that is. Like, that's kind of the struggle that's going on television right now.
Yeah, but see, so much in this regard depends upon whether you trust the messenger.
Right.
It's not whether the message is accurate, but whether you trust the messenger.
Right.
And what the Democratic strategy is, since they, you know, moved away some months ago or a couple months ago from the campaign of running on the legacy of Barack Obama to a campaign of discrediting Trump. So, if he is what they claim, a liar, a cheat, an opportunist, a narcissist, and all of that type of thing, even if the message is true, they want you to think that the messenger can't be trusted. So what difference does it make if what he's saying is the truth? You can't trust him. And so I think that is going to play a role in a lot of ways, we'll have to see. I mean, it was similar. It's similar to Bernie Sanders, who in a lot of ways was demonized in the black community by the Clinton people and the Democratic Party establishment.
Right.
But at the end of the day, as the campaign got into the northern states and the industrial states, like Michigan and Missouri and Indiana and other places, his message was heard because it touched a nerve with what people are experiencing. That might be the case with Donald Trump. Now, the other thing is the growing separation and distrust among broad masses of black working people and poor with the black misleadership class. So those messengers don't have a lot of credibility with the ordinary black person. So in a lot of ways, people are deciding, who should we trust in this election?
Right.
You know, who can we trust?
I mean, you see that you've got this really fertile soil for all of that. You're looking at just the polling numbers, the negative polling numbers on Clinton and Trump and the media and Congress and the institutions. Everything is completely discredited. And so people are processing everything through that prism. And, you know, again, for some reason, I keep thinking there must be some extra gravitational weight that's got to be given to the material as opposed to the virtual, because the discussion that goes on TV, the sentiments of people towards what goes on in their institutions, all of that, you know, those things are all virtual, and yet there's the actual material conditions that people experience that every time they look up, they get another jazz of, you know, the adrenaline or whatever it is that helps you store that experience, and they're like, yeah, right, I'm in a bad way. They're just reminded of it every day as they move through their lives, because that's their condition. That's our condition.
Right. But see, then Trump has a problem. He is running on, as we have mentioned, a progressive position on these trade deals and bringing jobs back to the country and how the system is rigged against working people, and his position against war with Russia and or China. That's progressive. But then when it comes to the social issues,
right,
he's he's running on a traditional Republican position.
Of necessity.
Even though he doesn't believe any of it.
Right, of
he
necessity.
He is a right... Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I was just saying of necessity.
Yeah, of necessity in certain ways because, you know, and I blame, and in fact, I blame Bernie Sanders for a lot of this.
Yeah.
Had he joined Trump, which he could have easily have done, I think, looking back at it now.
Yep.
If he had joined Trump, the Trump-Bernie Sanders alliance would have constituted perhaps the most progressive ticket that we have seen in this country since Franklin Roosevelt.
Maybe ever. I mean, if you imagine,
maybe ever.
If you imagine Trump and Sanders on the same ticket, you're imagining a workers' party in the United States that's a majority
Absolutely.
Party, like from the day it opens shop.
I agree with you. And see, that was the possibility. But that possibility was dashed because of Sanders' betrayal of his
right.
base and
yep.
throwing them into confusion.
Right.
So then Trump is only left with having to go into an unprincipled alliance with what is the right wing of the Republican base.
Right.
Now, then he had to resolve another contradiction. Once he went there, that is the so-called base, the gun people, the right-to-life evangelicals,
right.
Those who want a conservative Supreme Court.
Right.
So he has to be, you know, but then he makes another move. And this is as important when he rejects the support of Paul Ryan
right.
and the Republican Party establishment
mm-hmm.
and says he will go at this on his own and make his own appeal to the Republican Party base and mm-hmm. that section of the working class and the trade unions that are prepared to break with the labor movement leadership and the Democratic Party. So he has two competing wings of his campaign, the conservative base of the Republican Party and this working class constituency, which is still in the process of crystallizing.
You know, this that raises another question in my mind. We've only got like 2 minutes to do this, but you know, look at the phenomenon of Reagan Democrats and other similar instances of this where working class Democrats vote for a Republican candidate over white supremacy or, you know, military aggression. You know, we have mm-hmm. to get the Soviet Union or, you know, this is the white people's party. If they're willing mm-hmm. to cross over from Democratic Party for that, now in this dire condition, are they willing to do so on economic fundamental issues and war and peace?
Yes, and we will see. Clearly, the fact that he's still in this race suggests that large numbers of them will. This election is still a question mark. The polls, and everyone is admitting this, that the polls are not telling us what we need to know. In fact, polling has kind of reached a crisis. We keep using that word.
Yeah, well.
The big polling institutions are unable to get an accurate take on what is happening because people don't trust the pollsters. They don't trust the media. So if ABC or the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal
right.
sponsors a poll, right. People are not going to believe it.
Right. And their reporting of it, too. Tony, thank you very much. A pleasure,
yeah.
as always.
Thank you, man.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.